Okay. So I think I already explained to you what happened. David Cassaret went to Buffalo and was supposed to come back on this afternoon's flight and didn't realize that you could get snow in Buffalo in December. I don't know who doesn't know that, but David Cassaret did not, and he feels very bad. And so instead of having no colloquium, we're just swapping topics, and here we go. So remember that afterwards we have the Center for Bioethics holiday party, so definitely stick around. And it's not far. If you're not from here, it's just one door down. So we are, instead of talking about end of life, going to talk about patient-centered care and what happens in cultural conflicts and what the burden is, what the obligation is to deliver patient-centered care when we have conflicts that are actually deep value disagreements. So that is our agenda. And in order for us to talk about this, I want to start with a case so that we have it in front of us from the very beginning. Let's look at it first. Can you see this well? So I don't need to darken or... Okay. A male radiologist is called by the emergency room to perform an evaluation for an intrauterine pregnancy. The patient has come to the ER with bleeding and abdominal pain. The patient's beta is around 250. When the radiologist arrives in the patient's room, he finds her covered in a burqa. And the patient's husband explains that she needs to remain covered and that the radiologist will not be allowed to perform the necessary exam. The patient says nothing, and there appears to be no language barrier, so we don't appear to have just a miscommunication as the core of the problem. Okay, so here's what I'm going to do tonight, giving it to you sort of all out front first. Patient-centered care is the big buzz right now. Everyone is talking about it, all the deans, all the head of health systems. But the U.S., being as pluralistic as it is and as diverse as it is, has very often deep value disagreements. Not the kind of value disagreements or difference, cultural differences that make for good ethnic restaurants, which we all enjoy, of course, but actually values that very much are in conflict with each other. So my question is, what is the obligation to deliver patient-centered care when the patient's value conflicts deeply with the provider or vice versa? My process for going through this, for arguing here what I think those obligations are, is to start from an assumption of difference, because I think that we get into the problems we have because we define the patient and the provider as having very, very different values, being in fact quite different in an us versus them kind of thinking. So I want to talk about how the they differs from the us. And by the us, I'm going to argue mainstream dominant culture. So we can quibble over whether there really is an us, and yet I think when I start to talk about the values that are at stake here and where the conflicts are, we're going to see that there is a fairly universal group of American medical values, and that's what I'm talking about being in conflict here in this particular case. But then I want us to reconsider otherness. In fact, I'm going to take a controversial view of arguing that if we scratch the surface underneath those very important but and very apparent conflicts, we would get to universal values, overlapping values that would actually help us define the situation not as an us and a them, but an us and an us. And if we can get to us and us, if we can get to commonality, we're actually going to think to be able to think about solutions that really will be patient-centered. So that is our agenda. Reminding ourselves here about the case, in case you don't, the medicine of this case isn't immediately obvious to you, let me make sure that we are all on the same page that what's at stake here possibly is an ectopic pregnancy, that an ectopic pregnancy is best diagnosed with a pelvic ultrasound this early, especially 250 of a beta is very low. We're talking very early in a pregnancy. So an abdominal ultrasound is very likely to miss this very, very tiny, what looks like a spot. And an ectopic pregnancy can be life-threatening if you have a rupture. So just so we're on the same page about what the medicine is like in case you aren't clinically trained. So the first thing I want to do is focus on difference, and I want to think about a story we might tell, assumptions we might make. I'm not accusing us of making these assumptions, and I'm not judging us if we do. I'm saying that when we come to a situation, we bring with us our own template, our own lens. And when we look at this situation, we might very well see these features. We might believe that this is what we're seeing. So I'm going to call these the assumptions we might make if we define this situation as having a very high degree of difference between the us and them. We might, for example, look at this and say, the husband is speaking for the patient, and therefore he dominates her. He's the one in control, and he forces her to be submissive in this situation. That's why she doesn't get to speak. We might think the wife very much wants to participate in her care, and he's robbing her of this opportunity. He's stealing this from her, taking from her something she very much wants and is prevented from having this type of autonomy. An assumption we might make is that the husband refuses care based on a parochial modesty, not a modesty that's justified, not a modesty that can be legitimate, but one that is backward and parochial, and in fact puts his wife's health in jeopardy. That's how backward it is. We might think that if he were not there, she would absolutely consent to this exam. He's an impediment. He's an obstacle. And we might assume they are uneducated, maybe illiterate. Now, I'm saying those are possible assumptions. We might make none of them. We might make all of them. And I just want you to keep them in mind. I want you to tuck them away, because this is the position of difference that I'm starting from, where I'm ultimately going to try to convince you there are not these huge gaps between us and them. We'll see. So now I want to turn to commonality, to this more controversial position I'm going to argue, that there are universals that underlie their values and ours. And I want to see if I can contrast for you the radical otherness you might perceive and the universal values I think underlie this circumstance. I'm going to lay my cards out, and they're not going to be surprising to 95% of you, because you've had me in class, and I just say this straight out in class too. I am a Kantian, so I believe that all human beings actually share the same basic moral law in all times and in all places. Pretty radical view given the prevalence today of relativism. Now, in a nutshell, if you haven't been with me, though many of you seem to be veterans, you will know that the main Kantian precept can be put in a nutshell, though it's a little bit bastardized this way, and I'll give it to you in the real Kantian form in a second. But in a nutshell, it's the do unto others bit that you get in all of the major religious traditions. It can be said more formally, and Kantians like that. Officially act in a way so that your action could be willed at the same time as a universal law of nature. If you haven't had that in class, that sounds like a lot of jargon, but it really just means that in cashing out the do unto others, which came first in the literature, as a matter of fact, but nevertheless, when Kant gets hold of it, he's trying to say that the way that you act is legitimate, is morally permissible, if you could have everyone else act the same way. If you could make a law or a referendum that says, act in this way, and your actions were that referendum, and that's what everyone else would adhere to, then you would have the moral law, which Kant calls the categorical imperative. And I'm arguing this categorical imperative is actually operating at all times, in all places, in all cultures. Now, obviously, we must have to do some tweaking with this, because we know that there are deep value differences. So Kant is either going to have to be dim or subtle in explaining what's happening here, because it can't be on the surface this simple, or we'd have no conflicts. It is, though, an anti-relativistic position, that what's going to ultimately be the case is that differences can be very profound up on the surface where we all live and make our decisions. But what anchors the values that we all hold and that that we live by are these universal values. And then we instantiate them. That's the fancy word I love so much. We instantiate them differently in different times and places and cultures. So I want us to look for those common universals that are just instantiated, and that just isn't supposed to be small. That's, of course, the whole deal in terms of value differences, but that are instantiated differently in different places. So what am I going to argue they are? Autonomy, informed consent, and bodily privacy are the three values that I think are most pressing to talk about in this case. I'm not saying these are the only three values that are universal, of course not. I'm only arguing that I think looking at these three values actually illuminates quite a bit of this case. Informed consent might be the oddest one up there, because we know that as a concept, at least, it is a very American institution, and practiced in a certain way, it really is very much, certainly in the West, mostly in the US. But stick with me, and I'm going to give a working definition for each of these to see if I can sell you on the fact that they are universal, and then we'll look at what happens in our lived experience and how those values look can look very differently on the ground. Alrighty, so let's start with autonomy. Again, I'm going to give you a working definition and see if I can get your agreement that this fleshes out the concept adequately enough, and then I'll talk a little bit about what the difference is between the us and them in this particular case. I'm going to define it very simply: the right of self-governance, wanting to be able to self-govern. I want to stop for a moment and talk about the difference between self-governing and that right in one's daily life as a kind of patient, as a kind of general autonomy, and I want to distinguish that from patient autonomy, a very particular subset of autonomy where I believe that really is a U.S. institution. Perhaps now we're seeing that in other Western countries. Perhaps we're seeing it in many parts of the world, but it absolutely started out as an American idea. But I think sometimes we confuse patient autonomy for the whole when it's just a species, a subpart. So the right of patients to make medical decisions and exert their own individual control over their medical care is fairly new, and I don't want us to get confused here. So what do I think then is the universal if I want to bracket out patient autonomy as just a subset of general autonomy? Well, I think that that all individuals want to either self-govern, that is, I can self-govern by making decisions, I want to make them myself, or I can actually self-govern by deferring to your superior expertise. In other words, for me to exert my autonomy, I might make the decisions myself, or I might think that you are in a better position to make those decisions, and I might defer to you. Like, I defer to my husband on buying water heaters, and he defers to me on presents for his mother, and neither of us feels compromised in our autonomy. But there is a case of my handing over decision-making to him and not feeling like I'm in any way compromising my right to self-govern. I want us to keep that in mind, because I think it's instrumental when we get to the medical arena, where we have a template of patient autonomy that might blind us to any other mode of decision-making in the clinic. Now, when one's autonomy is compromised, and I think this is a good test case to see if we have such a thing, we would say of that assault to our autonomy that we feel oppressed, forced, coerced. If you can use that language, you must be operating on some principle that offers you the ability to not be oppressed, forced, coerced. Now, of course, what it's going to mean to be oppressed, forced, coerced is going to be so much a part of the story. Come on in, there's tons of seats. Again, let me reiterate this point that I'm making. We can't really talk about feeling oppressed, feeling forced, or feeling coerced unless we are agreeing that we actually have some concept that it could go by many names, like human autonomy. Because what would it mean? So I'm being blown about, so people are telling me what to do. If I don't care, I can't have those feelings. If I have those feelings, I must care. If I care, I care about self-governance in some important way. But what seems oppressive or forcing or coercive to me is not necessarily what feels oppressive to you. And it isn't just what feels oppressive to me, it's the how is it done. So I want to talk about the institution, for example, of arranged marriage for a minute. And I want to talk about how there is a distinct difference between an arranged marriage that I consent to, that I embrace and feel is good for me, and an arranged marriage against my will. You can have perfect autonomy in a marriage that you feel you have to defer the wisdom of decision-making or choice, or at least sorting process, selection process, to someone with a larger view. But in the end, you said, you know what, I think this is good for me. That's self-governance, even if in the dominant U.S. culture, an arranged marriage seems like the perfect example of loss of autonomy. It seems to me that's a very flat reading of that institution. On the other hand, if you're dragged into it kicking and screaming and you don't want that spouse, you don't think that person is good for you, and you really don't want this, that very much is coercive, or being forced or coerced. So what I want us to keep in mind here as we now turn to the case is, what is oppressive to her may not be what would have been oppressive to us. So let's go to that case. Because we define autonomy so precisely or so narrowly as patient autonomy, we are very worried about the patient's lack of participation in the decision-making of her illness. It worries us because we sometimes take patient autonomy for the whole of autonomy. So if she doesn't have patient autonomy, she's exerting no autonomy. There appears to be no patient autonomy, and we place such a high value on this version. The question is, does she place a high value on this version of autonomy? Well, there are two possibilities, and we have to acknowledge that there are two. She wants to exert her right to make medical decisions, but she's being prevented from her husband. That's the assumption we made at the beginning of the case, or at least that we might have been vulnerable to. Or she's comfortable yielding to her husband on such matters. She defers to him. It's her water heater. So then when we think about the husband, we could think of him as an oppressor, and we get a very particular look at him when we think he is robbing her of the power to make decisions. But he could be her protector. He could be freeing her from the burden of making decisions. And that type of deferring of patient autonomy is not limited to immigrants from certain parts of the world. Many, many times patients say to their clinicians, "What should I do, doc? Tell me what to do. What would you do? What would you have your mother do?" There is, if it's the second case, the protector, there is no difference here, except that instead of her speaking directly to the clinician as the trusted advocate, she's going through her husband as the trusted advocate. As a possible reading, I don't know. I don't know her. I don't know this case. I want us to think, though, out of the box here and perhaps separate ourselves from the assumptions we might make. So thinking about the universal there of autonomy, let's move to informed consent for a second. Again, I want to give a working definition to see if I can bring you along to believe that there really is something universal. So I want to give a definition that is quite general. Though we are in the medical arena now, so we've already narrowed the sphere that we're talking about. For informed consent, I am going to define it as the patient or trusted advocate is adequately informed about the patient's condition and treatment options, and she or he agrees to or chooses one of the proposed treatments or diagnostics. So informed consent isn't about who gets to make the decision. It's about the process that either I get that information or the person that is my surrogate does. Again, we are not unfamiliar in this terrain because anytime we have an unconscious patient or an incompetent patient, this is exactly the type of informed consent we have. But we also often have it with patients who are fully competent, who believe that there might be some advocate who is in a better position to take that information in. When my very competent father-in-law got esophageal cancer, he wanted my husband to know everything, to get the information, to process the information, and yes, in the end, to actually say yay or no to the various options, which were actually very complex. He was perfectly competent and perfectly well-educated, but he believed that my husband had more medical understanding and could handle these complex discussions better. So again, we don't need to go to another ethnic group or another part of the world to see that this is operating in our daily medical lives. And I think it's not controversial to argue that no one wants procedures done to them without either the patient, him or herself, knowing what they are, why are they being done, and then giving approval to it. Or having a trusted surrogate, advocate, decision maker, knowing and then approving. And that trusted surrogate, advocate, or decision maker could be a spouse, could be children, could be the physician. In fact, I've just given some examples where we see that without having to move to beyond the outside of the dominant culture, we see this all the time, in fact. So I want us to, in this case, assume a benevolent advocate. Sometimes we think that we are seeing a narrow-mindedness in a case like this where we aren't having someone who's looking out for that patient. I want to see if we thought about this person as a benevolent advocate, is there evidence for that claim? And I think there is. First of all, he brought her to the emergency room. So he has to have her medical interests in mind. He knows what this is. This is a hospital. This is about healthcare. This is about getting help for his wife. From the bleeding, it's obvious that this was a gynecological problem, and yet he brought her in. I'm going to stop for a second just to remind us of the case here in case you walked in and didn't get to see it. This is a case of a woman who's in a burqa. Her husband wants her to stay in the burqa, does not want her to have a pelvic ultrasound, and she's at risk for ectopic pregnancy. So from the bleeding, it's obvious that this is a gynecological problem, but he still brought her in. And a counter case, if we're thinking perhaps of not if when we're tempted to think that we don't have a benevolent advocate, I want to take us to the Taliban days, where women's bodies couldn't be viewed by men, women weren't allowed to practice medicine, and women died at home, unable to obtain treatment. Here we have someone who is trying to get his wife's health and life safeguarded. He obviously has an interest in her getting the health care that she needs. So my question is then, on informed consent, what does he actually know about her condition? And for thinking about that, I want to take us to what we often refer to as two of the elements of informed consent: disclosure, what gets said to the patient, and understanding with the surrogate, and what gets received back from the person who's making the decision, the patient or the surrogate. So I want to think about these questions. What has he been told? Does he understand that there's a possibility of an ectopic pregnancy, and does he know what it means? And I want to focus for a minute on the does he know what it means. When people talk about pregnancies or difficult pregnancies or at-risk pregnancies, it would not be crazy or irrational to say, let's take a wait-and-see attitude. If what we were talking about was the risk of a natural miscarriage, there's not much or nothing, depending on the circumstance, that can be done to forestall an early miscarriage. They are fairly routine, though sad for the couple involved. But if that's what he thinks about a pregnancy at risk, as opposed to an ectopic pregnancy that can be life-threatening, he might not have raised the level of alarm. He might not be pitching the crisis high enough that it's worth the sacrifice of the modesty or her dignity or whatever he and she are feeling is at stake. And while that might not sound plausible to you when it comes to ectopic pregnancy, because it's out in the vocabulary of the you know, of our, you know, normal parlance, we hear this term a lot, I want to take you to my own case of hearing about Franconi's anemia the first time, when this is the illness that sparked the PGID, the pre-implantation genetic diagnosis controversy about baby Adam, because the sister, the only child of this couple, had Franconi's anemia, and they were considering using pre-implantation genetic diagnosis to see if they could conceive a child that would have a bone marrow match for their daughter so that they could save her from Franconi's anemia. And when I heard it, I thought, anemia, it's low iron, give her some iron. Because anemia carries a great meaning to the lay public, but Franconi's anemia does not. Doesn't take long to get caught up to speed when you've made a mistake like that. But what we have to ask here is he on the same page as we are when we hear that term? And does he know that only an invasive pelvic ultrasound at this stage in the pregnancy could figure out whether the pregnancy is in the fallopian tubes or in the uterus? Does he know that? Does he know enough anatomy? Most Americans don't, so it wouldn't be unusual if he doesn't. Most of us don't. Okay, having thought a little bit about the universals of autonomy and informed consent, I want to take us to one of the big drivers in this case, bodily privacy, where we might feel like the distance between us and them is such a chasm we can't bridge it. And I think we can. So let's think about bodily privacy. First, let's get a working definition. I'm going to argue that bodily privacy as a value is the concern that parts of the body remain concealed from the view of strangers. And I'm going to argue that it's a distinction between the public body and the private body. As a universal, I'm going to argue that all cultures draw lines between what parts of the body can be seen and what parts may not be seen by the public eye. So which parts? And cultures draw lines demarcating what constitutes, who constitutes the public eye, and in what context body parts can be seen. So it's not just the body parts, it's who's the public. How large a circle do you draw when you have even drawn public and private as who constitutes the private and the public eye? And I want us to go back to that us and them, because this seems like a case where the bodily modesty of this couple looks so them, we can't get to an understanding of it as an us. So let's think about the them. The them that we're talking about is a family where they are living with the institution of purdah, which literally means curtain, the practice of preventing men from seeing women through physical segregation and the covering of the woman's body. If you are a woman living under purdah, only very close male relatives and other women would have seen even your hands, eyes, arms, neck, face, hair. And the burqa is the garment that you wear when you are living under purdah to protect the private body from public view, which leaves out just about everything. So let's think about purdah and the teaching hospital. Think about how casual we are about the numbers of people that interact, that examine, that question, or just view in the hallway, just as people are moving with wheelchairs or gurneys when you are in an emergency room. You think about, just as a laundry list here, and there are more, the triage nurse, the other nurses, the med students, the residents, the phlebotomists, the ED techs, the attendings, the specialists, the residents, the student nurses, the student phlebotomists. You know the list goes on, can be very, very large. I ask one of our ER attendings, give me an estimate of how many people would interact with a patient in this type of case. So I didn't make this up, she did, and she said 10 to 15 conservatively. How many would have been men, I said, given in a tertiary care center. So of course, I'm not talking about a small town hospital, and some of the questions we're gonna raise by the end of this, I think will center around what can a tertiary care center do and what can a very small outside community hospital, as they're called, not so pleasantly, not so favorably, I think. And we're gonna ask whether there are different possibilities. But her estimate, 5 to 10 would be men. Now imagine what it's like to have this experience. The first time any part of your body is exposed to a man who is not related to you. Now various parts of your body are being viewed by 5 or perhaps many more men in a short period of time. And by the time radiology is called to do the pelvic ultrasound, the resident might be the 5th or the 10th man to come into the door. And now let's focus on the us. You're probably going to raise the objection that we can't imagine this experience because we can't imagine having this level of bodily modesty. We can't get into the position of trying to think from her perspective or from his. The distance between us and them is just too far. And in the dominant American culture, you might say, we really have no concerns like this. In fact, when it comes to medical care, we just understand. The body needs to be exposed and examined to safeguard our own health. That's the healthy, right, self-protective, wise understanding of the body in medical care. And we are not vulnerable to this parochial view. So we cannot feel what she feels. To counter that, I want to make us into a them. I want to do a thought experiment. thought experiment, if you're rusty with your philosophy, is a circumstance where we make a scenario up that is fairly far removed from the one we're talking about, at least gets us an intuition, gets us a gut feeling or the experience of some situation or circumstance that we can then reanalogize back, having taken those insights with us. So I want to run a thought experiment. And I don't want to go crazy on it. I don't want to go to Mars, as philosophers like to do. I don't want to drown children in bathtubs or hook, you know, violinists up to kidneys or whatever. I just want to go to Germany, to a typical gynecology practice. And I don't mean 100 years ago, right? I mean Germany today. And why Germany? Because Germany is one of the medical systems that is very comparable to our own, and it is a population, a citizenry, a value system that is also very close to our own. Of course, there's always cultural differences. They're going to become quite apparent in one moment. But if we're going to think about a medical system that we respect with people like us, I think we can go to Germany safely. We're going to fly there. And here you are. Now, before I get you into the examining room, I want to say that if you are in the perspective of a patient, you know, then of course you must be a woman in this case. But if you are not a woman, and so you might not go to a gynecologist, I want you to think about being the loved ones of someone who would be going to the gynecologist so that we're all in the thought experiment together. This is how it will go. The nurse will escort you to a room with a curtained area. That sounds good. And in there will be a stool on which you can place your clothes. The nurse will instruct you to take off all your clothes and come to the examining table, hop up, and put your feet in the stirrups. And then the nurse will leave. Are we missing anything here? The gown. Are we missing a gown or a drape? There is no gown or drape in a German gynecology office. The gynecologist, the Frauenarzt, maybe in the room when you disrobe and walk to the table, I mean, it wouldn't be a strip show, you'd be behind the curtain to get disrobed, but then you'd walk up and hop up, and might be there when you put your feet up in the stirrups, and no nurse is present for the exam. The exam, health history, and post-exam discussion are all conducted with you just in that very circumstance, just naked, right there in front of him. And the reason I used him was because even though we've had a mass change in the quantity of women who have entered OB-GYN to the point now where men in OB-GYN are almost dinosaurs and not that many women go to male gynecologists, that trend has only started to happen in Germany, so your odds are very good that you will have a male Frauenarzt. Now, if you were in that gynecologist's office, how would you feel? I'm going to give you a list, and we'll see if any of it resonates. Demeaned, embarrassed, vulnerable, ashamed, mortified, humiliated, violated, powerless. Well, now imagine that there had been 5 male clinicians or more that had come into that room at various times in your appointment and were involved in different aspects of your care. Now you're going to object, because this is what you do with a thought experiment. As soon as you want to take down a thought experiment, you know what you need to do. You need to say, this is not analogy. This is not analogous. This will not translate back. This is too different to give us any insight. So when we're talking about abortion and we're hooking a violinist up to a kidney, I'm sorry, we're never going to get back there. That's what people do with thought experiments when they want to take them down. I applaud that. So you're going to say, rightly so, the level of exposure is not comparable in these two cases. No way. In Germany, you have complete exposure. In the Burka case, you have almost none. But I have a rejoinder, because that's what philosophers do. Right? Return of the Jedi. Here we go. The level of exposure relative to our respective cultural boundaries is exactly the same. That's what I'm going to argue. In each culture, there's a public versus a private body, and it's demarcated differently. And great care is taken in every culture to protect that private body. And when those culturally prescribed boundaries of privacy are crossed, the patient acutely feels the violation of those boundaries. So what constitutes the private body in these three cultures? Well, the line is going to be drawn by what parts of the body are allowed to be viewed in the ordinary and common public settings. In Germany, I submit, we have the sauna standard. In Germany, saunas, are mixed sex. You can go to the just girl, just boy one, but then you're probably prudish, which is the German word for being a prude. The sauna is a place where you go without clothing. In fact, if you bring your bathing suit, as you are all, I guess, want to do, they will tell you that it is unhygienisch, not hygienic, to be in the sauna with your bathing suit. I'm not sure why, because they also believe that when you are driving in a car with the window down, you will get a cold. Virus. But when you are on the bench, naked, on your towel, without a bathing suit, that's hygiene. And you might think, well, nobody would go there to the sauna. Well, that's not true. I remember arriving as an exchange student to my family's house. He was a doctor, and he had three sons. One was exactly my age, and so 17, 18. He had just had his sweet 16th birthday party not that long ago, and they had an indoor pool in their house with a sauna. And he told me, he had been an exchange student as well, so his English was really very good, and he explained to me that they were having this party, and, you know, and it came out somehow that all of the 16-year-olds were naked at the party while his parents were home. This was part of what the event was supposed to be, because how else would you be in the sauna at 16 with girls and boys together? I got a reputation for being a prude on the first day I was there, because my eyes got very, very big. And no, thank you, I never went in the sauna in that house. I don't like sauna, I don't like being hot. But in the US, we have the bathing suit standard. And in Perda, we have the burqa standard. Now, I'm going to try to cash out the bathing suit standard. Think about the hospital gown. Think about what's covered in a hospital gown, and I submit that's the bathing suit standard. Think about it. Think about you in a bathing suit, you in a hospital gown. Naturally, if you're a guy, you get better coverage in the gown. Hands, arms, neck, face, hair, back, legs, feet. That's the gown. That is the bathing suit. We employ the bathing suit standard, that which you can be cloaked in or uncloaked in on any beach in America. That's our hospital gown standard. It's not random. We use a very particular standard for bodily modesty, for coverage. Any beach or pool. But none of these body parts are included in the public body for a woman living in Perda. None of them. Hands, arms, neck, face, hair, back, legs, feet, none of them are visible, are allowed to be viewed under Perda by the public eye. So is the hospital gown a big deal? We often think it is. Imagine what it's like when you're living under Perda. The level of exposure, here's me defending my thought experiment, in a hospital gown is just as much a violation of bodily privacy as the sauna standard is to us. That's where I want to make the analogy. What does it feel like to be asked to be living under Perda and getting into a gown, I think, is the same as living happily in a bathing suit, not always happily in a gown, because some of us don't go to the beach, being asked to go to Germany in a gynecology practice where there's no gown at all. I don't think it's any more surprising that this woman would resist wearing a hospital gown than an American woman would insist on a drape or gown at a German gynecology visit. In fact, the power dynamics of medicine, though, make it very hard for a patient to speak up when they feel demeaned or vulnerable or powerless or humiliated. So would not many of us wish that we had an advocate there that would protect our interests and priorities, that would say, "Get my wife a gown"? Just then, as we did with autonomy, let's think about this in terms of bodily privacy. Let's think about the husband again. Let's think about whether he's an oppressor or a protector on the question of bodily modesty or bodily privacy. Is he preventing her from getting the care that she needs? Or is he safeguarding her interest when she feels powerless to do so? She doesn't want the exposure either. And she's glad he's standing there saying, "Burqa only." So what I've tried to argue here is that we can see universals, and then we see the culturally relative instantiations. But I'm hoping that this gets us to move away from us versus them thinking. I'm arguing these are different ways of understanding the very same core value, and we are not so different on any of these three. So then we have to ask, given the culture clash that we've got, these deep cultural disagreements, value disagreements, even if there are underpinnings of a universal, what would patient-centered care look like? Well, it means giving her care, I'm going to argue, that not only safeguards her health, but safeguards her values. I think that's what it means to deliver patient-centered care. So on autonomy. Whether she wishes she could exert control over her care and is being prevented, or she gladly defers to her husband. This is the marriage, this is the culture she's in, and he's the decision maker, we might assume. Now, ideally, you might be able to find a way to say, to ask her if she'd like to speak with the clinical staff alone. Maybe that's possible. It's always an ideal when you can make sure that the person is deferring autonomy, is granting autonomy to someone else. That is, of course, the ideal. Maybe it is possible, but maybe not. But what about informed consent? As the surrogate decision maker, the husband needs to be given carefully, sensitively described picture of the medical facts. Not browbeat, not coercive conversation, but respectful conversation that talks about the risk she's facing, the purpose, the consequences if an ectopic pregnancy is missed, and a stance of negotiating her care respectfully, not from the stance of you are wronging her, but from the stance of you care about her health and so do we, how do we work together? What will he allow? Requesting his help. When we think that there isn't us versus them, we actually talk differently. We don't talk the same way when we think we've got two us's in the room. And what about on bodily privacy? Well, can the number of people who interact with this patient be minimized? Can a female tech or radiologist do the pelvic ultrasound? Can a female emergency room resident or attending do the pelvic exam? And can these exams be done while she's still wearing the burqa with additional drapes? How far can we go without compromising her health, her medical care? How far can we go? Now, a possible objection might be this. If we gave her special treatment, we'd have to give everybody special treatment. Patients all need to be treated alike, and we cannot accommodate requests for special categories of providers. Where would it end? It's a teaching hospital, and as my second grader loved to say, you get what you get and you don't get upset. Except I have a response to the we can't give special treatment, to the we treat everyone alike. I want to rejoin with the pavilion. I want to take us down the street to the pavilion. Pop. Some floor, I don't know. I think you have to be rich to find this part of the website because I had to get a nurse to help me find it so I could, I knew it was there, but I think it's like a secret code, like country club language or something. The pavilion is a $500 a night suite that you can buy, add on to your care at HUP. I don't know if you can read it, but you get express check-in and check-out, right? You don't wait with the hoi polloi in the line. You have a private room with soothing amenities as fine linens, a plush robe, boutique toiletries, and actually, I couldn't get you a good picture here because they no longer do slides of it because they've just upgraded from rooms to suites. Used to be for the bargain price of $350, you could get a room, $500, it's a suite, they've renovated. So we have to have the whole suite, and that kid's gonna keep out the hoi polloi. So $350, some, you know, a lot of people do it. $500, you're part of the club. But now, when you do it, you have to take a virtual tour, so I couldn't get you any snapshots of the fine toiletries, the personal chef, they actually show you him, the china, and the best of all, the afternoon tea.
It's very nice, too.
I'm sure it's very nice, and I know that we all want to go there. Now, what I want to know is, you know how when you're in the hospital, in a tertiary care center, the teaching hospital, and you've got 15 med students walking around with you at the bedside gawking, you think they're going to the pavilion? Do you think they know where the pavilion is? I don't believe it. I don't believe it. In fact, when they say the finest care and they show a picture, that guy's gray. He He is not learning. He is not a student. He is at the very top. It is attendings only, thank you, up there on the pavilion. It is the best nursing care, most experienced attendings. That's what you get. So when I hear, well, we don't do special treatment, that is not true. We do it if you have the money. And you might think I'm picking on HUP, and I'm not. Because I want to take you back 20 years before Harvard's teaching hospital got wise to how you actually do this. And I want to take you to the Brigham and Women's Hospital, where it's having little procedure. The Brigham and Women's Hospital is set up to have pods. Four pods on the tower. And then you go up, and there are rooms, I don't know, 20 rooms in each pod. When I was there, they're double rooms, but if you get really lucky, you could get single, because maybe there won't be enough people there, so you could get a single room. When I was there, there was a sheik there. And I don't know what part of his family was getting care, but a loved one of a sheik was getting care. So I want to ask you, do you think that they got a single room? Do you think they got a single pod? Or do you think they got two pods walled off so that when you get off the elevator, the entire west pod was preserved for the one sheik's loved one in one room? So it isn't just HUP. My point is simple. My point is that when we see a need to give special treatment, we absolutely do.
It might be worse care, though.
Yes, the irony is that, right, exactly. Like, you might have somebody who's actually never taken staples out because they've taken staples out, but it was 30 years ago, so they don't really know how the gadget works anymore, and you'd be much better off with a resident. That's true. I agree with that. But in terms of the principal objection, I think it doesn't hold. So where are we here? I think sometimes patient-centered medicine doesn't address a core feeling we often have of my way or the highway, thinking about patient care. We'll go a certain distance in patient care, meaning when it does not undermine our core values, when it doesn't cause us much trouble, when it feels very easy. But it's a commitment, if we're really taking patient care seriously, to meeting patients on their own terms and meeting the values they come to the clinic with. I think we have to try to avoid us versus them thinking. It's not just because it's a false dichotomy, and that's a lot of what I wanted to argue tonight. It is a false dichotomy, I believe. But it lessens our resolve. Perhaps more importantly, it's the other downside of us versus them. If we don't think that we are the same, then we don't think there's a we that we have to protect when we talk about patient-centered care. We talk about the idiosyncratic, the outrageous request, the irrational request, the one that can't be justified when we're involved in this dichotomy. So we need to focus on commonality rather than difference, especially as the U.S. becomes more diverse, because if there's going to be patient-centered care, then there has to be patient-centered care for all. I am done. All right, let's take questions.
Mm-hmm. Well, the patient has sort of voted with their feet. They have, to some degree, rejected their own culture when they emigrated to the United States, because they have done that, as far as one can tell, somewhat voluntarily. So I much appreciated how you made that analogy to the German being, experience being so further down the road than the American experience. But to some degree, the immigrant has voted with their feet and made a somewhat ethical declaration that they value American values to some degree. Do you think that can be incorporated into it?
Well, I think if it is incorporated into it, it will permeate and have ramifications far greater than just this instance of patient-centered care. It is very much a my way or the highway kind of thinking about immigration and what those values, what values one needs to adopt to be part of the club. The thing is, though, it's not just immigrants who have different values inside the U.S. We have plenty of people in the U.S. who have been card-carrying, passport-carrying Americans for decades who have very disparate values between each other. And so where will we make a decision about whose values there get respected or not?
I just gave that talk yesterday.
Oh, you did? Well, good. Then you have the answer so we can hear it and then we can, you know, move on. Go ahead.
That you don't have, you know, there are obviously different cultures within the United States. So I was talking about African-American culture and how that has gone a somewhat different path than, say, the Caucasian experience of healthcare. I would just, it's true, but there has to be some cultural negotiation in every clinical.
Okay, let me give you the kind of example I'm thinking about. Let's talk about the traditional American position. Now, I don't mean that it's happened. It's the dominant one now, but it's certainly, we have a very long history of the position that women are actually inferior intellectually to men. That was a position very much in the dominant culture. Now, the women's movement tried to take that one down, and I think we've gotten to a place now where many people think a female versus a male clinician, and you've got IQ-wise, you know, same thing, you know, you're right there, even Steven. But the reason I want to go back to that particular example is because we can find moments in our own culture and still many, many white, WASP, long-term Americans who have that same view. And yet, in the clinic today, if you say, I don't trust women as clinicians, I think you'll probably want to say that's not a position that we ought to honor. So then it seems to me we're a little bit fast and loose with what's going to be the cultural mores that we allow to dominate in the clinic. That one was very traditional. There's still plenty of people who hold it, if not the majority, certainly, I think not, certainly a core minority. And yet in the clinic, if you walked in and said, I won't be seen by any women, I just don't think they're good enough, today the PC culture will say to you, I'm sorry, you get what you get and you don't get upset and women are just as good. So I think there's a little bit of an arbitrariness here about which values we are allowing to be respected. In the case, it seems like what we've sort of done is not talked about traditional American values, but talked about what's ever politically correct in the value spectrum today. So right now, women and men are equal is the value that we think in the politically correct culture is the right one. But it certainly has a long American history. When it comes to a woman who doesn't want to conform to our understanding of patient modesty or informed consent or autonomy, then we say, again, it's not even politically correct, but it's just the mores of the time. Hey, our way or the highway, you came here and you have to live by our standards. I think a better way in a pluralistic society is not to take a stand on which values the clinic is going to force on people, but to try to meet people where they are. Now, maybe that is a controversial view. But honestly, I'm asked this question, and that's the question I thought you were going to ask. What if somebody comes in and says, I won't see you, Autumn, because I don't think you're as smart as a man. You just couldn't possibly be. And I have a controversial response. I would say, you know what? Political change doesn't happen overnight. Let me see if I can get you a guy. Because I don't think that our business in the healthcare arena is to transform people's values. I don't think that the hospital is the locus. It should be the point where we do political education, especially given that we have seen the instantiation of values sway.
But as you nicely laid out, it often is the site of this cultural negotiation that it does have to occur in order to have the clinical.
A cultural negotiation I have no problem with. What I'm worried about is that we get very overly confident about the power and validity of our own instantiations of our cultural values. For example, now let me give you another example of this one. I gave you the example of someone saying to me, you're not smart enough to be a doctor because you're a woman. We are at least as likely and maybe far more likely to have a woman say, you're not doing my mammogram. You're a guy and I want a woman. But here's the interesting thing. Do we say, oh, I'm sorry, you get what you get and you don't get upset? No, we have entire institutions where there are no men in sight for a mammogram. We have entire radiology practices that say your mammogram will only be done by a female tech. Once again, I'm trying to argue that we have decided to side with particular values and not necessarily the ones that say we're all equal and the same.
I agree with you that the clinic may not always be the best place to try to change trusted values. You might say, for instance, the patient who doesn't want to have a woman physician. At the same time, I think that we should need to bracket the fact that we do. And in this case, I have this, you know, middling piece in the back of my mind that this is also a justice issue. And while I would probably respect our clinician, the desire for this person to have a woman examine her, I do question whether she really does have the kind of autonomy that we would want her to have. That's not something that we can remedy overnight, you know, in the ER. But I think you give a little too much on the autonomy side of it.
It could turn out, all I wanted to do was introduce the possibility that there are two possibilities. This could be the stereotypical case where she has not only no voice in the clinic, she has no voice in her life at all. But we have plenty of American marriages where we're not talking about immigrants, where a woman has no voice in her marriage. All I want to do is open up the possibility to say that it could be more complex than that, and it could maybe not look like that. Absolutely, when we see injustice, we are going to want to argue, if this in fact is an example of injustice, which we don't know if it is, we have the obligation, I think, to stand for our beliefs somewhere. But the question is, do we have an obligation or even a right to argue for our values in this particular setting? Is that the purview of the doctors and the nurses? Or should we say, after we've had an opportunity, you know, would you like to talk to me alone? If she says no, I don't know what we want to do. Besides that, I think we are where we are, and then we should be saying, how do we get her draped as best possible? And why should we allow a white American woman to decide that she can have only a woman rad tech when she gets a mammogram, but if you're a woman of color from a place and you are not in that power position, you can't have a woman doing your pelvic ultrasound? It makes no sense that we absolutely support women giving mammograms to other women, but we do not support women giving pelvic ultrasounds to women. When invasive-wise, I don't know about you, but I mean, there's a whole other level there. But I agree. I'm not trying to whitewash at all. Certainly no. Did I cut you off?
No,
no constitution. It's good. It's great. Certainly no constitutional right. True. But it isn't the case that I'm going to try to argue back with treating like cases as like. If we never kowtow to any patient's desire for any particular thing, but we do. We routinely have women giving mammograms, women gynecologists, men, male urologists, routinely. Now, here's the great news, and this is why I don't think we have to duke this out at a policy level, because I think one of the questions you're asking is, should a hospital simply put their foot down and say, I'm sorry, you get what you get, and you don't get upset, because all of these are equal persons, and we believe they're equally trained, and that's what you get. I've already tried to show that we don't actually act like that, but regardless, you're trying to argue, in principle, ought we to put a policy in place that says, I'm sorry, we just don't do that.
So I have no problem with putting a policy in place and ignoring it strategically that we can't move forward any other way. I have a lot of problems saying that our policy is to accommodate under any circumstances, because that is unworkable to me.
That's exactly where I want to go.
Certainly a lot of discretion on the floor, right. Given the options, given the resources, given the urgency.
Right.
And so I don't mind allowing people to break rules as long as they don't come up to me and say, hey, you know what I just did?
I undermined the rules.
Broken
on the
rule.
Yeah. Here's the thing. that's a version, a subtle version of the objection I often get when I give this talk. And it's this. Everyone would want something different. Every woman would say, I won't be treated by a man, and everyone of any particular ethnicity would say, I only want that ethnicity, and it would go on and on. And I actually don't think that's true. I think that by and large, especially over time, we do come to see, to believe, most of us do believe, that we really are apples and apples and apples and apples in the healthcare setting. So I think we're actually talking about a very small group of people, a very small group of instances. But I do think that to be patient-centered is to say, here are the mores, here are the values that we have as an institution. This is what we would hope we all can live by, but to meet you where you are, and if that's not where you are, I'm going to do my best to accommodate it. I understand that it is controversial, but I don't think that what the hospital isn't putting into place a policy that says you can choose whatever you want because people aren't different. They're saying people are different, but you may not think so, and if you don't think so, I'm going to do my best to meet you where you are. And to me, in the end, we've gone, I think, further with enhancing patients' medical care, and here's why. I think that, let's imagine that in that parable, I love that parable, where you have the contest of whether the sun or the wind is going to blow off the coat. To make a policy that says you get what you get and you don't get upset, to me, is to blow the wind off the person. The other way is to shine the sun and say, you know what, okay, we're going to work with you here. We believe that this person is absolutely qualified, but we're going to work with you, and we are going to see how can we work together as a team. My guess is, over time, we're actually going to have fewer and fewer of these instances. I don't think we're going to have to change what we do at the policy level to understand that we really do work with a plurality, and the best way to get someone to reconsider, you know what, maybe women are just as good doctors, isn't going to be to force me on them. So I guess, while there's an in-principle justification, which I really like and feel some, you know, some sympathy for, when we're talking about the kind of change that we will need to have in order for us not to be doing this all the time, it seems to me the only way we can do it is to meet people where they are. If you forced me to have a male doctor when I didn't want one, you would have won the point that you believe that he is just as good for me as she. But you have not convinced me that he's just as good for me.
Mm-hmm.
But then you're not interested in patient-centered care.
You can go somewhere else where you've made your needs fulfilled. I'm more interested in running your organization in a reasonable way or a reasonable throughput that allows me to just function when I'm overloaded to the beginning. If the demand of the service didn't outstrip the supply of service, I have no problem with doing it the way, but I've yet to walk into the place where the servers sit around and say, well, I'm just waiting for the one I can handle.
Well, that's what I would like to test. Because I would like, what we have to do, I mean, I think, and then we're going to have to go have our party. I'm going to answer this one, and then we're going to table it, but we can absolutely chat after as well, all over, because I promise that we can head to the thing. What I would like to do is see what kind of backup lines would we have if, in a case as extraordinarily and as unusual as this one, we said, hey, can you take over this case and we'll trade? How much backlog would we have if instead of asking her to be in the gown, we could get some surgical drapes that are in the closet and lay them over her legs? Would we really have that much of a backup? And if we would, then I think we would have to do a cost-benefit analysis. We'd have to say this principle versus the cost, and we'd have to think about it. But what I'd like to do is see, well, how far could we go, how quickly, with how little trouble? And if it is the case, and that's a very important objection, there are no people here but men. You have an ectopic pregnancy. We judge you to have this and this much time. We have nothing but men here. There is a hospital down the street. Perhaps we can get you. We can call and find out if they've got some women available. Right now, we can't do it is also patient-centered care. It is not to say we can do anything and everything for you. It's to say, to the best of our ability, we will try to meet you where you are. But if we can't do it, we don't have the resources for it, we don't malign you, we don't condemn you, we don't sanction you or speak pejoratively to you. We say, we can't offer that. Not go home and die from an ectopic pregnancy. We say, I know that HUP has lots of women on that ER staff. All right, this has been great. I'm going to stick around, but it's 5:30, it's 5:40 basically. So I'm going to table it here, but I'll stay here if anybody else wants to ask questions, and everybody else can start the party. So thank you all very much. Great question.